For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So when I first chanted this, I felt a unified love coming from our lineage, coming from our ancestors, coming from the Buddhas, coming from the Zendo to me to ease my suffering. I already was feeling an ease of suffering by the time I was sitting in a Zendo. But when we actually chanted this, it was very powerful how connected we are and how much compassion the universe is actually giving us in our struggles. And that the Buddhas and ancestors were like us. They were these flawed beings. They were these beings that struggle so heartily. They were these beings that make mistakes. They were these beings that are cruel to other people. They were these beings that are trying to figure out biases and prejudices. So I just love this chant so much. And it also always gives me a sense of hope. When things get very hard, it gives me a sense that even if we're not seeing the end results that we want in our individual Dharma positions, we have to have faith in the larger stream of manifestation that's happening. So this chant itself is for arousing the vow. And normally the vow is considered one of two things, but really they're both symbiotic. It inspires us to keep practicing, meaning it creates bodhicitta. It creates the intention for us to want to keep doing this practice, to want to keep sitting zazen, to want to keep getting together as a zendo. It also inspires the faith in our practice. And then it also inspires us to practice not only for our individual self, for our individual ease of suffering, but so that we could bring everybody we're with together to the other side, to the shore of enlightenment, to nirvana. So this chant is supposed to help us keep that flame lit, keep that intention lit, even when things get very difficult. We know in our Buddhist practice, there's generally considered like three tenets of our practice. One is precepts or sila, which everybody knows easily enough as doing things like do not lie, do not kill, but also concentration, zazen, which is us sitting in stillness, which is considered our natural state of being. And then wisdom, which is supposed to develop because we're practicing the other two. But it's a symbiotic relationship. One doesn't happen because we did one, and it's not a linear progression. These things are supposed to develop in concurrently with each other. There are three, and everybody knows, do not kill, do not steal. We know these. But sometimes we forget that underlying the great precepts or the more practical ones that see us through our daily life are the three pure precepts, which are embrace and sustain all action, sometimes translated as sustain ceremonies. Embrace and sustain all that is good. So it's a more general and broad configuration, and embrace and sustain all beings. And then our more particular precepts kind of arise from that. When we sit in zazen, so we know when we study Buddhist thought, Buddhist teaching, Buddhist sutras, these precepts are inherent in the things that we study. And it's really hard, even if you don't do zazen, it's hard not to know what the precepts are. Because oftentimes people just engage with those even before they do zazen, which was actually my path. The zazen puts us in stillness, in our natural state. And in this sense, we learn to be with what is. Dogen tells us to shine the light within. So as we're sitting and shining the light within, we're able to see eventually what actually comes up. And then as we practice Zazen consistently or consecutively, we're able to look more honestly at the layers of the things that come up within us. Because we all know as human beings, the easiest people to lie to is actually ourselves. And we're experts at kind of denying things that happen, even in our own individual lives. So I don't want to look at a big, you know, scope of problems like we are right now in the world. But it's very hard for most individuals to be very honest with what's actually going on inside of themselves. Zazen is a great tool, since it's our natural state, to learn how to examine those things honestly, fearlessly, and in a way, privately. We don't have to necessarily let everybody know what's really going on. And we also don't have to admit to everybody what's really going on. So in a way, it's a safe space to look at how we're responding to the world around us. So I want to give you an example of how the Zazen practice has actually helped me with a bad habit that I have. I know ever since I've been a child, I'm a very impatient person. All of you who know me know that I'm an impatient person. It's not a surprise. I've been working on it my whole life. One of the ways I express my impatience is I cut people off when they're talking. I've done that all my life, and I know it stemmed from impatience. Through my Zazen practice, though, I was able to really be accountable for the fact that I cut people off. You know, I just do it, but now I could finally take responsibility and say, you know what, kind of a jerk when I do that to people. My precepts are telling me right speech is important. Is it right to interfere with what someone's saying and kind of, you know, that's not what right speech is telling me. If I look at the paramita, compassion is part of listening. We learn that listening is a very important part of our practice. So if I'm cutting someone off all the time, I'm really not practicing compassion. So then I could start looking at, okay, I'm impatient, but am I really a compassionate person? Maybe I could work on that a little bit. So when I see myself cutting someone off or hear myself doing it, I could pause, because the Zazen has taught me how I could take a pause, look inside and figure out what's going on, and saying, wow, I'm not really practicing compassion right now. This is a perfect opportunity for me to practice compassion and see if I could keep my mouth shut and really open my ears and listen to what this person is telling me. And then that becomes easier to do the more you do it. So most of the time, I might be doing that, and I'm very comfortable doing it, and it's not an effort, and I'm not even thinking about it. Sometimes I still have to think about it. Now, usually, here's more Zazen. When I have to think about it, I'm getting angry or frustrated at what's going on. I might be angry and frustrated at that person that's talking to me, or it might be about something totally unrelated. But that's why I want to cut this person off. They're in my path. They're talking to me. I'm angry and frustrated. Bang, I just want to cut them off. But now I know from studying the self, this is what's going on. So I can then practice compassion. And then sometimes I know this is going on and I don't care. And I cut them off anyway. And there is such a joy and a good feeling in doing it, because I know I was angry and frustrated, but I did it anyway. I figured they're going to, you know, bang. At some time, you know, because I'm admitting I'm human, sometimes I need to do that. I still have a dualistic position. I still have a ego that says Paula that wants to be the one, you know, operating things. And it really feels good when I realize it and I cut someone off with all those things going on. And then I could sit with that at another time. And you know what? Thankfully, Ancestor Dogen told me I could have repentance over that. When I do my ancient twisted karma, when I do the repentance verse, I could say, you know what? I was really a jerk then, but here's the time when I'm looking at my practice and I'm vowing to try better. I'm vowing to do better. And I'm releasing the anger and frustration and the fact that I failed. I'm releasing that. I'm letting it go. I'm renewing myself. So this chant tells me that I can do that time and time again. I'm bringing that up now for a specific reason, basically because of what's going on in the world right now. And it's very hard to figure out how we need to respond, what we need to do. Now, we know there's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of suggestions going on. There's a lot of programs. There's a lot of action. But we have to remember that the most important thing is we have to look at ourselves. We have to study what's going on inside of us as we move through the world. And we also have to study it with brutal honesty. We know we like to stay in our comfort zone. Part of the problem is that, really, when you think about it, we don't want to challenge ourselves. We don't want to be nervous. We don't want to feel that life is more difficult than it already is. So we tend to stay in our comfort zone. And when we find things that are unsettling to us, we either find a fast way to get back to the comfort, or we start denying what's actually happening inside of us. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the racial strife that's going on now, but I wanted to talk about it from my own personal experience, you know, so sorry, but I've lived in Chicago my whole life, and it's been very difficult to watch this. But I want to talk about it honestly. So I don't want to say that I'm telling anybody what they need to do. I don't know what anybody needs to do, quite honestly. I don't. But I want to tell you how I've responded to events in my life throughout the years. The first time I was aware of racial strife, like many of us that are over 50, was in 1968 when the Martin Luther King riots were happening in Chicago. I was 6 years old. We were watching the riots on television. And it was the first time in my life my parents were terrified. I grew up in a white Polish ethnic neighborhood. I never really saw a black person, not even on TV, except for Bill Cosby. Right? Everyone remembers he had a show. He was the only black, and maybe Flip Wilson, but otherwise, Sammy Davis Jr. Okay, maybe three, and they're all men, mind you. Anyway, I never actually saw a black person for real. So we're watching these riots. My parents are terrified, and they kept saying, oh my God, I just hope it doesn't come. I hope it doesn't go into our neighborhood. Because we're on the south side, but we're on the southwest side. So we're really in between. It really happened more on the west side. We were in a pocket in between south and west black communities. But this made quite an impression, as you can imagine, on a six-year-old. You never see your parents terrified. They're literally terrified, like the whites of their eyes are showing. And I look at the TV, and what do I see? A bunch of black people ripping up neighborhoods and burning stuff down. So my fear started there. We're not talking about the fear. I don't hear us really talking about the fear that we have as white people. So that was my first engagement with race relations. And because Chicago is a very segregated community, when I was growing up, everyone knew this. You did not cross the street and go into a black neighborhood. And a black person did not cross the street and go into yours. So even if, like, for example, you're on Halstead, the black people were on this side and the white people were on this side. If you were white and you crossed the street and you got the crap kicked out of you and you ended up in the hospital, no police were called, nobody was called. That was how the rules were. And if you were black and you came on this side, it was the same thing. Okay. And I mean, literally, I had friends and I saw, like, if someone got lost, you see them running in terror to get out of the neighborhood, and you'll see three or four people running after them with bats and pipes. No guns necessarily at the time. People had guns. Now, mind you, this now is 1968, 1970, 1971. This is what was going on in Chicago. Okay? This is not in the antebellum South or Jim Crow times. Okay? So now we know all the civil rights reforms happened in 1968, and Tige and I have talked about this a lot. A lot of people pushed through reforms, which was wonderful and needed. But then the courts started making societies enact the reforms. So Chicago was one of the last places to actually enact school desegregation. And the Supreme Court forced us to do it because we weren't doing it. There was a lot of legal challenges to that. So I was fortunate to be one of the first people to go to one of the first high schools that were being forced to integrate. Now, this at this point, it was I graduated grammar school in 1976, and I started high school shortly after that. We had race riots in the school every year. And when I'm saying not little skirmishes, police being called, people getting thrown off of balconies, gangs of people beating up two or three people, teachers trying to break it up, and then they getting jumped on by everybody else and all this kind of stuff. Now, in the middle of all of this, you have to understand that you have black people, you have white people. There's this conflagration going on. And everybody's interpreting it through their own filter, right? So I'll give you some snippets. Like one of the things, of course, a lot of the parents ran to the school to pick up their kids when they, and now it was no internet or nothing, but once wind caught out in the neighborhood that stuff was going on, the schools would start calling parents to pick up their kids. You have this group, it was amazing really, because you have all these white parents coming, you have all these black parents coming. They're both terrified and they're trying to find their children, right? And it's funny because now I'm kind of around the white parents, right? Because my parents are there and the black parents are there. But you hear the conversation, can you believe the black parents are just as concerned about their kids? Look at that, I had no idea. No, see, that's what I'm saying, okay? But it was a problem, but it was opening each side's eyes to the humanity of the people in the middle of it. It's not going to happen just by this and reading and all this stuff. This is real life stuff that opened the eyes of people. Now, unfortunately, there were still people suffering while it was going on. I'll give you another example from a riot. It started breaking out. So my hope, I was always just so terrified of this. You know, this goes back to 1968. So anything happened, I'm running the other way. So it breaks out. I run out of the school. I want to run home. I'm running as fast as I can. It's like a mile and a half run. Okay. And then I see somebody I know from my neighborhood, but they're in a car. You know, I'm like a sophomore. So they beep at me. I wave at them. I'm like, oh, thank God I could get in the car and I could get home faster. I jump in the car. I'm in the back seat. They drive down Archer, make a right toward the projects on 47th and Cicero. And I go, where are you going? Where are you going? We're going down to the projects to cause some problems. And I'm like, no, let's go home. Let's go home. So I run down. I fall in the back seat. I'm by the seats on the floor of the car. And they're driving around the projects. You know, you friggin' ends, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, we're going to get killed. Stop, please. Okay, so we got home. Nothing happened that day. Okay. Now, I bring this up to show you that different people in that situation responded differently. It was easy for some people, or karmically, they developed more compassion and empathy, and they saw the humanity that both sides were suffering in this conflagration. Other people dug in even harder, and it just reinforced their opinions about why racism is a good thing. And I'm bringing this up to say that it's so hard. It's so hard. Okay. I want to bring up one. Now that's just even before I was 21. So I want to bring up, and I could go on and on and on. I'm almost 60 years old. When I started working downtown, down at the exchanges, you know, it was a diverse group of people, but mainly the people that were doing the trading were all white men at that time. And everybody else that was working to support it were women and minorities or like working class white people like me. Now, I want to say I'm not mad about it. It was a great opportunity. Like if you didn't go right to college, if you couldn't, that was a job you could have and you could actually follow a career path. Okay. Now I know as a white working class, it was easier for me to follow that career path. It definitely, at that time, it was impossible for people of color. So, I mean, I knew that at 18, though. So we're all suffering. We're all trying to get a piece of the pie. But I knew that the fact that I was white, I would be able to progress up. And minorities at that time, they could pretty much forget about it. They weren't going to go anywhere. They were going to stay in the jobs that they had. They might become a manager in that department, but that was going to be it. And then, of course, for women, it was harder, but it wasn't impossible. So there were very few women down there at the time as well. And, you know, we're all fighting, depending on our dharma position, to have an opportunity to have the right to excel. You know, everyone's doing the same thing, but they all have a different category that they've been put in. But I also want to stress, I'm not anti like white guy, because it was white men who gave me the opportunities to excel. So it's very complicated. You know, that's all I'm trying to say is that we want to make sure that we don't create the other every step of our way, because it's much more complicated than that. But anyway, I was hanging out with a couple of guys. One was a mixed race guy, half white, half African American, and his friend who was African American. We started hanging out with them, me and my best friend, two little white Polish girls from the southwest side of Chicago. And they would take us to South Shore, which was a primarily black neighborhood. They go, let's go in our neighborhood and party. Now, me and my girlfriend were like, no way. We're terrified to go. They just kind of yuck it up. And they go, don't worry, we're just going to go to our place, you know. So we'd go. And, of course, we're underage drinking. They might have been of age. So we're drinking. We're getting a buzz on. And then they go, okay, let's go out and let's, you know, hit a bar or something. And especially me, I'm not paying attention because I'm having a good time. And we go into a bar, sit down, and my friend's like kicking me under the table. And I'm like, what? You know, because I'm talking to William, you know. And she's like, look around. So we look around, and we're like the only white people in the bar. Now, again, I was just terrified. I was like, you know. But, of course, I didn't say anything. Where am I going to go? And I can't get home. I can't go on a bus in a black neighborhood at like 11:30 at night. So I'm stuck with these guys. I'm not sure what they're doing with us, right? Bottom line was, guys, they were opening our eyes. And they knew nothing was going to happen to us. And they knew that we were so afraid. And they, thank God, they opened our eyes. And we had a wonderful time. They did a number of things like this to us in different kind of scenarios, like sending us into the liquor store and all this stuff. It actually is pretty funny. But they made me realize there was nothing to be afraid of. You know? Now, I was fortunate to have that relationship with these people. And I'm not saying like, oh, I'm so like open-minded. It was just one step in front of the other that karmically just put me in the right position and put them in the right position for our lives to intersect. So we need to be cautious and honest with ourselves. And we need to look at our responses as we go out into the world and try to bring people into the dialogue. I want to get more specific now about why I'm bringing this up. You know, even within our lineage, we grapple with the fact that we lack diversity. And I listened to a Dharma talk that David Zimmerman gave, who's the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center. The talk was called Looking Back to Look Forward. I've been involved in the San Francisco Zen Center lineage for the last 10 years, and I know that they've been grappling with this lack of diversity ever since I've been involved, with really not much improvement. Like, there's been some, but really not anything to speak about. And David brought that up, and then he said, we don't like to speak as if we're an institution, but we are. Now, they're speaking as San Francisco Zen Center. And he said they had a meeting in the Sangha. They invited people of color that were part of the Sangha, and they really had a very honest discussion about what are we not doing. And it was really the first time, I think, that they honestly said, what are we not doing? What could we do? We want to hear you actually tell us, no holds barred, how you feel. And he was very brave to give this talk, and he was very brave to bring it up. But I want to use that as an example of the leadership we need here also in Chicago. You know, I personally feel if we don't have diverse voices as part of the dialogue to what our solutions need to be, we're just going to find ourselves back here again 30 years from now. I want to read again what Longya says. What in past lives was not complete, now must be complete. In this life, save the body coming from accumulated lives. Before enlightenment, ancient Buddhas were the same as we. After enlightenment, we will be exactly as those ancient ones. We need to carry that with us and bravely move forward and let this Sutra give us hope that even maybe when it's not obvious, now as you could see what I'm talking about from my past, we have a lot of work to go. We have a lot to do, but there has been improvement in Chicago. There has been improvement. But is it enough? No. No. But we can do it. And I ended on time.
So I'd like to invite those of you who might have questions or comments. We have about 15 minutes for discussion. Is that all right with you, Paula?
Yes. And if you can monitor the hand raising and stuff.
What I'd like to do is just have people
jump in
physically.
Okay.
Okay.
And just to add, if people are not on screen visible for Fushin or Paula to see raised hands, you can go to the participants on the bottom and find your name. And at the bottom, there's a place where you can click on raise hand. So we can also monitor that. Thank you. And thank you, Paula, for speaking frankly about all of this. I appreciate it a lot.
So, David?
Paul, first of all, I just want to thank you for your honesty and your openness. I mean, that was truly remarkable to share. So I really appreciate it. I really, really appreciate it. I'm jumping in a little quickly because I'm throwing this out to the Sangha to know. I'm studying to be a chaplain, so I'm at Loyola, and I've taken several courses now that deal with liberation theology, and read several books. And in a large part of the Black community, they look to the Gospels, and the Gospels promise salvation. And this goes back to slave days, that what we have now is something we have to endure, but we will have salvation later. We have to live with it. And it's very much how they were indoctrinated in the Christian faith. And so to go ahead and to reach out to Black people and say, hey, come, you know, to us. You go on the South Side, it's all MBEs, all Missionary Baptist churches, evangelical churches. And you do have Catholic churches there too, but it's always about salvation and looking at the end. And I wonder, you know, I think the only thing from my point of view that we could do as far as diversity is concerned is just to be with people and accept them where they are religiously and just be with them in a social interaction, because they may be coming from a whole different place than the very basis of what Zen is, the very basis of what Buddhism is. It's a very, very different place, and it's something that's existed for hundreds of years. So for us to go in and say, oh, we want to be diverse, come on in and be Buddhist. Wait a minute. That goes against everything they've experienced in their life, religiously, you know, and emotionally, that got them through that struggle. So I just want to point that out. And I think it's important for us as a Sangha to reach out to people in social, political ways, but to think that we're going to get people to come to Buddhism, you know, because of what it offers, I think we're missing the mark and denying their experience and their way that they grew up and how they believe and what's important to them. And that's my thought. But Paul, again, I want to thank you, having grown up in Chicago and seeing the same things. And in 1968, being in what was called the Deering neighborhood, marching with Martin Luther King, with 2,000 cops lined up along the street to protect us from the white people throwing bricks from the alley over the houses to try to hit us.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that vicious. You know, I've seen it like you. I didn't experience it on a daily basis like you did, but it's there and it's real. And thank you for being honest and courageous to talk about it.
Well, thank you, David, you know, and one reason I want to bring all this up is because I know other people have had experiences like me, and for some reason we seem to be afraid to talk about it. I was afraid to talk about this today. I almost had a migraine. I had to take 2 ibuprofen before. Because, you know, like when I'm really emotional, I start getting... Because it really is, you're afraid of saying the wrong thing. You're afraid of being judged. There's so much stigma. There's so much stigma around these issues. But I do know people who actually live in the neighborhoods, we talk about race all the time. We don't pretend there's no race. We don't pretend there's no difference between a black person and a white person. And everyone's pretty vocal about it. You know, I don't mean that, you know, you're this, but if we have a conversation about something, I'll give you an example. Cabrini Community Center is downstairs from my school. I've been trying to offer scholarships to them. The guy who runs it, it's like, well, you know, I'm like, I'm having a hard time getting children to take advantage of the scholarships. And he'll say, you know, Paula, I've been sending people up to you all the time. But if a black person walks up the stairs to my studio, I'm not going to just say I have a scholarship for you because now I'm assuming they don't have any money. Mm-hmm. But I said that to Vince. You know, I said that to him. I go, Vince, I can't tell a black person that here's a scholarship just because they walk through my door. You know, so we kind of settled on let him kind of screen people and then let me know and have them come up and go, I'm interested in the scholarship, you know? So, but we had to honestly say that to each other or there couldn't be any progress, you know?
Yes, that condescension of here, I'm the white guy and it's my white man's burden to help lift you up, you know, and that's
right,
kind
exactly.
Of, you know, you have to talk it out and make it real so that it's person to person and not some institutional do-gooding, which is just condescension.
Or it's just racist to think that if a person of color walks through my door, they don't have any money.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say thank you, Paula, for talking about the fear involved, because I think on all sides that fear is an obstacle, so I just wanted to say that. And Nicholas had his hand up. Maybe he could just...
Yeah, I just wanted to thank Paula for your honesty. And your talk was so compelling and heartfelt, you know. And it's such a hard issue to talk about. And I just loved how you really spoke from your own experience and your own heart. And you know, many of you know that I'm a leader in the Insight community, and, you know, we've tried to address this issue and continue to on an ongoing business basis, but it's so difficult and brings up so much. But I just loved your talk, and I thought that it was super relevant to the times and what I'm going through as a person, so... Deepest bows. Thank you.
Thank you.
We maybe have time for one more question.
Kathy.
Paula, thank you so much for that talk. It makes me want to cry. this time has been very emotionally exhausting. And so I get what it stirs up. And my experiences have not been yours, but I have had a lot of experiences in Chicago where I could not figure out how to maneuver a situation around race. Like years ago in the 80s, I helped start an organization in Pilsen, and it went well, and it was a useful organization. But eventually there was a sense that they wanted somebody who was Hispanic to be leading it. And I remember feeling like okay, I have overstepped my somehow position. But it's like there's an, but there's a sense of getting your own ego out of the way in some of these things, and figuring out how to join and how to be useful in whatever way you can. And now I also find it's difficult having conversations with sometimes family members, sometimes friends around racial issues. That is a continual emotional challenge lately. But maybe it's good that these things are in the air, that they're up, that they are topics to be addressed right now, even though it's difficult and we don't know exactly how we're going to move forward. But thank you very much for that honesty. I admire it.
Kathy, thank you. And you're right. What I want to really convey to everybody is that this isn't going to end in 3 to 6 months. This is going to be years from this pandemic and from the riots and everything with the killing of African-American men all coming to a head, or African-American citizens all coming to a head. The work that we need to do, it's not going to get better. And that's what I know. As white people, we just want to be comfortable, man. And that's what I'm saying. It's like our Buddhist practice tells us about impermanence. It tells us life is constantly changing. But as white people, our privilege, whether you have a lot of money or not, we've been able to control our environment. We've been able to have a place where we don't think there's going to be violence and probably won't get broken into. We're not going to, if we get sick, we can run somewhere. And, you know, like there's so many things that feel aren't uncertain about our lives as white people. That is the white privilege. And that's what our, and now this is my opinion, that's what our society, when it overtook other resources and it killed other people and all this stuff, that's what they were trying to do for themselves, is stabilize the uncertainty and impermanence of life. So white culture has done that probably more than any than royalty in the old days. Okay? So the problem for us is the minute we get a little uncomfortable, we feel we've done enough, or we deny that, you know, I'm a good enough person, or I don't need to do that, or I don't need to put myself in this discomfort. We have to acknowledge if we really get diverse, we are going to be uncomfortable. It doesn't mean we're going to have bad lives. But we can't just like kind of walk through our life without paying attention anymore. Do you know what I mean? I know you all know what I mean. Like put the headphones in and not have to worry about a thing, you know, as we get on the bus or get in the car or whatever we're doing. That's going to stop for us. It doesn't mean that we will never be comfortable again, but we're not going to be able to take that bubble everywhere we go anymore. Because that's been my experience, you know, living in the neighborhoods in Chicago with all the changes. There's not a bubble that I could stay in all the time. But thank you. You know, thanks, universe. So, thanks, Kathy. I think Nicholas has his hand up.
Oh, I think we're kind of out of time now. I'm sorry. Can we go on? Tigan, would you like to take? I need to let you know that I need to leave at 11:15 today, so I'm running on a little bit of a short schedule here. Sorry. So should we take one more question? It's fine.
I just wanted to say that to thank Paula for just bringing this up, and we're going to be talking about all of this for a while. Not, you know, other things too maybe, but as white people. As a white person, we need to face this huge legacy in our country and the difficulties of it. And part and our practice is to be willing to be uncomfortable. So I thank you, Paula. And I'll be talking about this next Sunday in part. This is not, as Paula says, this is a long-term discussion. So. Maybe we'll close with a closing vow and then we can make announcements.